This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend. I've walked your snow-capped mountains.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicos. Today is November 17th, 2020, and this is episode 216. I'm Scott Delonaboom.
And I'm Stuart Prest.
Stuart, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, my pleasure to pinch hit for Ian, who couldn't make it this week.
Yeah, Ian's off tonight, but he should be back next week. And in the meantime, today's show is going to be about what's happening with the return to the legislature, as well as the new round of COVID restrictions that were announced today. But first, we've got to thank the 100 people who contribute every month. You can support the show at patreon.com/politicos and help us keep putting out this content every week. And of course, as always, Politicos is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicos, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to politicstoday.news/free-trial. Let's jump into our first segment, The Writs Are In. So this past week, the chief electoral officer returned 86 of the 87 writs, with the final one coming in that was just delayed a little bit due to the judicial recount happening in West Vancouver, Sea to Sky, which we'll touch on in a bit. But that means the election is basically officially over now, and the BC government is planning its next steps on how to bring back the legislature, get a new cabinet up and running. And that's going to start next week with the members of the legislature being sworn in on Tuesday the 24th, followed by cabinet on November 26th.
So that means we have a little bit of everybody's favorite political parlor game of cabinet speculation. And there is one big job to fill, and that is to replace Carol James, who has stepped away from politics for personal reasons. And so the province needs a new finance minister. And I guess that's where some speculation can begin. I think there's a few names that come to the top. David Eby has been at the forefront of every dumpster fire that the province has had to deal with and has handled most of those files quite well. And so he may be someone who moves up into what is generally considered the most senior cabinet position. But then again, he's been doing such good work at Attorney General and has been such an effective front-facing cabinet minister that John Horgan may prefer to keep him there. So then we may look to other names as well.
Yeah, and then we also have a few big name star candidates who made the change from federal politics to provincial politics, such as Nathan Cullen and Finn Donnelly, who both won their seats and are no doubt expecting a cabinet appointment.
Presumably, that's part of why they jumped in. But there is going to be a need for balance here. So presumably, the NDP is not going to want to end up with a cabinet that is less representative of the province, that is older and whiter and maler. Is that the word? No.
Yeah, especially with Nathan Cullen already having that hanging over him from the campaign.
So I would expect that we will see the advancement of a couple of other MLAs. Bowen Ma comes to mind as someone who may be in line for a promotion. So she's been an effective voice for the NDP in the last few years. And I believe she was a Secretary of State previously. So she may be looking to take on a larger role around the cabinet table this time around. And so that may be one name to consider. And Ravi Kallon might be another one who seems potentially tapped for newer and bigger things. And those are both potential cabinet ministers who would give the province, give the government a little more of a diverse face matching the province that it represents.
Yeah, I agree with that. So do you think they're going to create any new portfolios? Are we going to get BC's Minister of the Middle Class?
It does seem like governments, when they hit a middle age, that's when they start to engage in these sorts of midlife crisis type activities for governments, where they invent things and don't necessarily need to be there. But the NDP has been so cautious and incremental in its approach to government. I am, generally speaking, not expecting anything overly dramatic from this government. I don't expect a lot to change from where they were prior to the writs being dropped. And in part, that's because the NDP mostly had their way with the confidence and supply agreement. Most of the things that the NDP wanted, it got. The Greens were able to put a stamp on the Clean BC plan, and there's a few other elements of the definitive push to get to electoral reform on the front burner that was in part at the behest of the Greens. But with that all out of the way, the NDP has more or less governed the way that they wanted to govern for the last 3 years. And so I expect to see more of the same. So I would be surprised to see a brand new ministry popping up out of nowhere, although I suppose stranger things have happened.
Yeah, I think they're more likely to put some of their political capital into things like card check, which got blocked by the Greens last time and will no doubt be controversial when they bring it in, but seem much more in line with what they want to do than branding themselves as the middle class party and the federal government likes to do.
Yeah, I've made the comparison between the provincial NDP and the federal Liberals before. There's some interesting parallels between the two parties and the way they're positioning themselves as a progressive but fairly centrist version of a progressive party, very incremental in approach and trying to reconcile the seemingly irreconcilable, say, in environmental action and also developing the energy sector. And there are a number of ways that they do resemble one another, but I don't know if they would go so far as to create a ministry of the middle class. The one thing I will watch for is their action on province-wide childcare. That seems like that's a place where this province, this government has wanted to put its flag. And so we would wait to see what comes of that in the coming year. So I'd expect to see some announcements there, but otherwise it'll just be focused on the near term. I expect a lot of talk about getting through these next 6 months. There's a light at the end of the tunnel now with a couple of vaccines on the way for COVID, but we're still very much into the thick of things. And I expect most of the communication to be focused on restarting the economy or growing the economy or otherwise navigating the problems through this economic and medical double whammy that we're in.
That brings us to the throne speech when we're going to have all this laid out. So the date for that has been announced as December 7th, and we don't know a huge amount about what's going to be in it, but what we have heard is that it's going to focus on just the things you said about keeping people safe during what will hopefully be the final stretch of the pandemic, as well as the economy.
And we have this $1,000 check rollout to be managed. And so we will look for some information on that. That was one of the major sort of front store window promises that the government made or the party made coming into the election. So I expect we'll hear more about that. But I heard some speculation that the government is trying to, or I believe as John Horgan said, they're trying to get it out for Christmas, but that is a pretty tight timeline. So I don't know if they're actually going to be able to realize.
Yes, that was what Horgan said during his press conference early this week. So I'm sure they would love to have every family with $1,000, most families, the ones that aren't means tested out of it, have a nice check sitting in their bank account right. When the holidays roll around.
Although that in itself I found is a bit of a marker that this is a middle-class government, the fact that you can have a family income up to, I believe, $175,000 and still qualify for at least a sliver of that $1,000, that's a pretty broad income range. And so that takes you well past the median income in the province. So that's a wide and comfortable definition of middle class, and that moves the NDP away from this version of the NDP away from some of its more hard left or harder left antecedents.
Yeah, it certainly does. Let's move on to the final riding, whose results just finally came in this week as the very narrow finish in West Vancouver Sea to Sky, which we mentioned on last week's pod, had to go to a judicial recount. Elections BC has finished it, and it has confirmed that Jordan Sturdy, the BC Liberal candidate, has won with 9,249 votes to the BC Greens Party, Jeremy Fellerotti, hope I'm pronouncing that, who got 9,189. So a very close finish for them. This was a, on election night, it was a huge upset that Greens won this. It prompted a lot of celebrations on their part. And then as the mail-in ballots came in, that flipped the other way, much to their chagrin. But no doubt they are going to be keeping an eye on this one in the coming 4 years. And this will be one of those hard-fought ridings in the 2024 election.
Yeah, and it's a genuine three-way race here. So the NDP was some ways back, but they definitely placed. And so it will be interesting to see. It's possible that the Green vote here was in part something of a protest vote against the Liberal Party. This is traditionally quite a safe Liberal seat. And so I wonder if some of those voters may find their way back if the Liberals find their feet. And they're clearly going through this process of renewal now, having have their hats handed to them in the last election. And so that it may be a temporary result for the Greens, but it may be a harbinger that this is a party that can compete on the mainland, that it is not a party centered on lower Vancouver Island. And so they managed to finish the second in a couple of places around the lower mainland. And so we may be heading to a different kind of party configuration here. And this riding certainly seems to be indicative of that. So I think the Greens are right to be disappointed here, but there may be something to take from this result that they can certainly continue to build on. And it suggests that the party is more viable than voters may have thought of in previous eras.
Right. And there were a couple other ridings where they did not too badly. It's Nelson Creston. They've, for the last two elections now, finished second. And you could easily see a situation where 4 years from now, the NDP is a lot less popular. Those ridings really are three-way races, and they come in and scoop up a couple on the lower main, or a couple on the mainland, both in the lower mainland here and in the interior.
Mm-hmm. And it's a pure anecdote, just the worst kind of data. But I was interested to hear that. So I'm doing some of the call-in shows on CBC and elsewhere, and the folks coming in from the interior were just fed up with both the NDP and the Liberals. And there were at least those who were active enough to call into a political call-in show were really serious about taking a look at the Greens, that they were taking seriously issues facing the forestry industry in a way that the Liberals were not able to deliver on, and the NDP had really not been able to reach out to those voters effectively. Again, it might be just the person who happened to call in, but the Greens might be able to speak to some of the issues that resonate in the interior with regard to forestry conservation that the other provinces are not currently able to communicate. Something else to watch.
Yeah, that's interesting. For the most part, the Liberals ran up pretty healthy margins in the interior. So I could see this being one of those situations where, yeah, a few people are pretty annoyed about it, but come a few years' time under a new leader that has hopefully rebuilt the party, that the dissatisfaction with the Liberal Party will probably fade away a fair bit in the interior.
And we do have to watch this temporary potential sort of possible crack up of the Liberal coalition, where we have Conservative candidates doing better than they had any right to expect coming into this election. That kind of self-inflicted wound may heal itself. The party may come back together under a new leader who can provide a new campaign, a new set of slogans. But then again, if the next Liberal leader does try to shift more to a sort of a clearly progressive stance on social issues and so on, that may lead to all sorts of unexpected dynamics in some of these areas where the Liberals have traditionally been strong, but perhaps start to lose some support in different directions.
Yeah, well, the new leader certainly has their work cut out for them. The party started to begin the process of figuring out how they're doing a leadership race. They've put out a survey trying to get members' inputs on that. So we'll likely be hearing in the next few weeks to month or two about what's happening, when they will in fact have a new leader selected. There's been a bunch of discussion about whether that's going to be sooner or later. There's kind of two schools of thought on that. One is that take as much time as possible to really figure out what the party is before rushing into a leadership race. And the other one being that they just handed a pretty bad loss, and they need to begin the process of getting a new leader who can actually be introduced to British Columbians ahead of the next election and have the mandate to actually build in a new direction.
That's one of these questions. Do you have the policy debate in the course of the leadership race, or do you pick a leader who is then tasked with moving the party through a policy debate? And there are different ways to do it. In general, the choice of a new leader is one of the clearest opportunities for parties to chart a new course politically. And that can happen whether the issues that are focused on are focused on in the election or not. So we see that at the conservatives in the federal level, for instance. Aaron O'Toole is pretty clearly moving that party in a distinct direction in terms of trying to appeal to working class voters and talking about issues like inequality and unionization, which are not themes you typically hear from conservatives. These were not major debating talking points during the leadership race, and yet here the party is going in a new direction. I think from a democratic theory perspective, you would prefer to see a fulsome debate within the leadership race, and that might lend itself towards thinking about taking your time and trying to hear from different wings of the party in that leadership renewal debate, where quite often in these leadership races, the different candidates that step forward will represent different factions or different channels within the party coalition or the broader movement within which the party is embedded. And the fact that the NDP is well entrenched in a four-year majority can be to the Liberals' advantage in this very particular sense, clearly not in a lot of ways, but they can take the time, if they want to take the time, to go for a more serious process of introspection and renewal. They can have a bit of a longer leadership debate or a leadership contest, or at least a pre-searching period where they allow some of this discussion to play out, because they're not going to be facing the voters for 4 years. So even if it takes 2 years to finish that process, you still have 2 years to introduce your leader. So as long as they are fairly efficient in moving on to the next step, they have a lot of time to work with and get their feedback under them again.
It's going to be a little hard to get their feedback under them until the old leader is fully out, because Andrew Wilkinson was back in the news this week as the fallout from the election continues. It started early this week when Jane Thornthwaite, the outgoing MLA from North Vancouver, who was at the center of the controversy about the roast, penned an op-ed in which she took aim squarely at Andrew Wilkinson for not apologizing properly, throwing her under the bus, and having a double standard when it came to male and female members of the party.
Yeah, it continues to be a tough year for Andrew Wilkinson. It started, interestingly, it started with a certain amount of promise, and yet it's gone from bad to worse in the election period and the aftermath, where he may not be around much longer. It's not even clear that the party is interested in taking him up on his offer to stick around as leader until the next leader is chosen. I think given the need for a fulsome review of where the party is, and given the extent to which his particular leadership has come under withering attack, it may be time for him to shuffle off the stage sooner rather than later. I mean, the sooner the party can turn the page on this particular loss and start talking about the next chapter, the better. And he, at this point, is nothing but a reminder of the fact that the party lost badly, but also the party seem to make mistake after mistake, and this op-ed by Thornthwaite is just the latest salvo in that, to point out that Wilkinson was not responding quickly in the way that she herself was to the controversy surrounding her comments, and it seemed like Wilkinson was willing to call her a bit of a fool, which is not the nicest thing to say about your MLA, even if they have made a mistake, and not necessarily do so to someone like Lori Thronis, who was a much bigger problem for the party for a much longer period of time.
Yeah, there's really no way I think the Liberals would be better off keeping Andrew Wilkinson around. There hasn't really been, as far as I can think of, a successful transition period where the outgoing leaders really stuck around long after it was clear that they were no longer really helping the party very much. And there was a leadership change needed.
It makes sense if the party is sort of moving from strength to strength. You've got some sort of hand-picked successor who has a lot of support within the party and you're just passing the torch. Then why not? And we've seen that historically with some parties, but we haven't seen that kind of dynamic recently. Much more often when party leaders are leaving, it's time for them to go. Everybody is well and truly done with them, at least in the short term. And of course, their image is often rehabilitated, particularly if they won during their time in the leadership role, but Wilkinson doesn't even have that going for him. So yeah, I think that it's better for him, better for the party, just to turn the page and let someone else run this process of renewal and stand in for the party.
Yeah, I think the last two fairly high profile examples would be Thomas Mulcair and Andrew Shearer, neither of whom came off particularly well or really helped their parties after it was clear they were on their way out.
No, both, you're right, both became, they remained lightning rods for criticism for the party and for the exact same reasons that they had not necessarily enjoyed the success that they had hoped as leaders. And so it just remains as a reminder of a past the party's hoping to forget. Yeah, we'll see how that plays out, but that would be where my money would be as well. All right, so I think best to leave Andrew Wilkinson where he is and head on to our next segment, which is looking at the sweeping new measures to control COVID-19 as the province masks up. We are looking at mandatory masks in public spaces and province-wide restrictions on a variety of activities. So if you were counting on getting out for hot yoga in the next few weeks, you're going to have to change your plans.
Yeah, so this comes after several 2 weeks now, debate around the current second wave that we're all experiencing and the BC government's response to that and the public health response in particular. So we talked a bit about this last week when the last slate of measures were introduced, but since then we've been setting even higher records for daily new cases and to a certain extent, that was expected because there's somewhere in the order of 7 to 14 days laid between any new policy and it really showing up in the case numbers. But nevertheless, everyone's, I think, emotions were running pretty high in the lead up to this. But this afternoon was when these got rolled out. So the main items is that all indoor and outdoor community and social events are suspended for the next 2 weeks, regardless of number of people attending. So the 50-person cap is now a zero-person cap. In-person faith services are suspended. No speculators are allowed at any indoor or outdoor sport events, and no traveling outside the local community for sports. Businesses are being asked to suspend any plans to return staff from work from home to the office. Also, all businesses need to reevaluate their safety plans, and the province will be stepping up inspections and enforcement of businesses, as well as the public health is asking people not to travel outside their communities or for non-essential reasons. And finally, weddings, funerals, and baptisms can proceed, but now there's a 10-person cap and there can't be any receptions.
So it is the shoe dropping that has been long awaited here. And there was a certain amount of controversy with regard to the introduction of some of these pieces. It's only a couple of days ago that Bonnie Henry had an op-ed published basically saying that the mandate for masks was already in place in a way that it needed to be. And yet here we are 2 days later with a much firmer, what you might call a proper mask mandate or a definitive mask mandate. And
an actual mask mandate, I think, right, would be reasonable. It was such a weird and bizarre framing that she took on this. So the op-ed said, some people are asking when we will see masks mandated in BC. The answer is that they already are. Which, and then goes on to talk about how it's because businesses and organizations have COVID safety plans, which should include masks, but this is an almost, it's an overused phrase, but like I'm having trouble thinking of an alternate term for this. It really did feel a bit like gaslighting to say that there is a mask mandate in place when there very clearly wasn't.
It does seem like a part of the strategy here is to make it seem, or it had been previously, to make it seem like there was as much of a provincial order in place as possible without actually putting a provincial order in place for a variety of things. And we still see that with some of the restrictions on travel, for instance. So there's a recommendation, a very strong recommendation to avoid all non-essential travel, phrased in ways that make it seem like people might say, wait, is non-essential travel still possible? And it turns out, yeah, it's not actually an order. We're not going to try to enforce it, but it's just such a strong recommendation that hopefully that takes on some sort of force of action. But that doesn't necessarily cut it for everyone. And the mask issue, I can understand why there's a resistance to moving towards a lawful approach where the lack of mask wearing is subject to effectively some kind of police action. And we don't know what that will look like, how the province is going to handle that issue just yet, totally, if somebody is not wearing a mask. But there's a concern there that if there is a complaint-based process where you can call a number and some sort of authority will show up if someone's not wearing a mask, that will end up falling harder on racialized populations within the province. Of those at on the margins of society are more likely to be targeted by any kind of process like that or any kind of random attempts at enforcement, because those communities in general tend to be more often targeted by such actions. And I can understand that kind of argument, but there are other considerations, and there are potentially ways to mitigate those effects, I think, as well. And the other considerations, and this is something that actually one of my students explained for me in pretty clear terms. So he works at Subway, and so every time a customer would walk in without a mask, there's this fundamental quandary for this person who is not making huge amounts of money, and they are the face of the enforcement of any kind of mask policy without a government order. And so do they try to antagonize customers, ask them to put the mask on, potentially antagonizing their employers, or do they have the backing of their employers? And there's so much up in the air when it wasn't a true mandate from the province. And so now we have that. And so now those Subway employees, everyone else can simply say, I'm sorry, you have to put on a mask because it's the law. And that's a much easier thing for them to say. It takes a lot of responsibility off their shoulders, I think.
Yeah, the equity issues were something that got flagged in the somewhat confusing op-ed that was written. And it's a very valid point. On the other hand, there's also a built-in assumption there that COVID isn't disproportionately impacting those communities, which anecdotally it seems it is, but the province has been not very forthcoming with the data on that sort of thing. So there's that issue, as well as, if we're going to wait till we manage to solve racism before we take pretty significant steps in the face of a spiraling amount of cases, that's a really good recipe for inaction and letting things get worse. Whereas there is very much a clear need to act quickly to stop further spread and flatten the curve, or I guess push the curve back down. We don't want it flat at 500 cases a day. We want it to be going down quite a bit. And with that, you can wait till you have everything, you know, just sorted out and perfect and have an absolutely perfect system that of enforcement all figured out. But that's going to be a long time from now. And in the meantime, that means a lot of people are going to get sick and die, or have long-term health consequences from this. And that's not great either. Which I guess comes to part of my irritation with how BC's been handling the second wave, is that they really do seem to be slow walking a lot of things. Richard Zussman, reporter at Global, reported that the mask mandate may not even be in place for another week as public safety has to figure out a bunch of stuff. as well as we found out about the press conference today, yesterday, when the premier teased it during his announcement. And if the situation's bad enough where you're having to put in mandatory masking everywhere in public, it's bad enough that it needs to be done quickly, because a good plan now is better than a perfect plan in a month's time.
I think there is some value in just signaling that this is on the way. So part of the value of having a mask mandate in public spaces is that it removes uncertainty and it signals the seriousness of purpose that a sort of a reliance on store policy or corporate policy does not, right?
Or even a sternly worded pronouncement from the public health officer. It mandates carry a lot more weight, even right. Just psychologically.
So, and I think I suspect that the health department, and obviously Dr. Bonnie Henry is at the center of this, is they're trying to grapple with all these fairly intractable problems simultaneously. And so by putting the information in front of British Columbians as soon as they have it, we've now seen this happen a couple of times where there is an initial announcement and some of the details take some time to work themselves out. And I think they are trying to be as upfront as they feel they can be. And so sometimes announcements come even before the kinks have been worked out of how it's actually going to work, just so people can start to prepare themselves. And I'm willing to give a certain amount of slack in that regard, just because this is a difficult thing. And the province is having to react on the fly to circumstances that are clearly starting to get away from control in a serious way. And I can understand why we're finding out sort of the headlines without having the action put in place just yet. But it is frustrating to wait a little bit longer just to find out what exactly is this going to be. But I hope that just to go back to our previous conversation, I do hope that when we do find out about what the enforcement looks like, they are able to really grapple seriously with these issues of targeting certain populations. I would hope that's the sort of thing that we can deal with in the planning on how to enforce the policy and do it with a sense of the structural inequalities that exist in society and with regard to facing the threat of COVID, because I'm quite convinced that it is more prevalent in marginalized communities and has nothing to do with people following the rules so much as just that's where people with essential services reside, people who are working in long-term care facilities and hospitals and so on, and where there may be less space for families to reside, just more people living in closer quarters. And it's just that is an economic reality and an unfortunate one.
So 6 months ago, I probably would have agreed with you about cutting the province and the decision makers a fair bit of slack, because it was a new virus. The situation was unfolding very rapidly. There's a lot of unknowns that needed to be worked out. And yeah, it made a lot of sense that there was going to be orders that would be imperfect and have to be patched quickly. We'd be waiting a couple of days while they figured out how to do stuff. But a long time has passed since then, and we had a summer where there was very little community spread. We went for about 2 months, I think, where there was under 20 new cases a day. The province had a fairly long respite from being hit with the virus very badly, and when I watch them kind of scramble to respond to this now, I just got to wonder, what were they doing for those 6 months? Because none of what's happened in the past couple months is really surprising. Everyone knew there was going to be a second wave. It was very likely it would be concentrated in one health region at a specific time. So what I don't get is why it seems like the province is trying to figure out a lot of this stuff on how they were going to respond when cases picked up again, as cases are picking up again, rather than in August when there was the time to really plan this out and know, okay, at 500 cases a day, this is what we're going to do. Why does it seem like the plan's being written as it's being implemented rather than ahead of time?
Yeah, and I think there's some validity to that. For sure, there were some things that seemed like they were inevitable. I know that there, given that not all 500 case loads would be created equal, there's some limits on how much you can plan for contingencies and have a sort of a clear threshold when we're going to move from plan A to plan B to plan C. I think I don't have any particular inside knowledge on what was going on in the department over the summer, but I suspect they were operating at or near capacity just to get through the days and the weeks. And there was a respite, but by large scale planning, timelines, that's not a lot of time to put into place fleshed out contingency plans. These are the sorts of things that take months or years to develop, and we were just getting off the tail end of the last wave and trying to figure out what would it look like when we're reopening schools and planning for that second stage. And my guess is the civil service has more or less been trying to think one or maybe a half step ahead at most at all times, and there just hasn't been the excess capacity to do the kind of longer term contingency planning that we would like to have happen in government. I suspect the capacity may not be there, and that's why things are being developed on the fly. And that's not ideal, but sometimes that is inevitable in the midst of a crisis.
Speaking of schools, there's also a couple things that were, I think, notably absent from the new policies that got put in place today, such as places where you do expect a fair bit of people to be gathering that didn't really seem to be mentioned. The one I think that's stood out for me the most is the restaurants haven't been ordered to be closed, even though you're not supposed to actually meet anyone anywhere, which seems to put them in a really weird limbo where they're not instructed by the government to close down and cease operations and one would hope there'd be compensation to keep them economically afloat during that phase. But at the same time, they'd be facilitating people breaching the public health orders if they did have anyone come into their restaurant. Movie theaters, I was looking on the public health website. They're still listed as you can have people in a movie theater as long as there's a COVID plan in place, which if you're not allowing anyone to watch sports, why are you allowing people to watch movies when it's entirely going to be inside, unlike a bunch of sporting events? And finally, schools haven't really had a change in them either, although I gather there's been a few more places now that are had outbreaks.
Yeah, it is interesting, the pattern here. And I think it's, again, the government is being pulled in these different directions. And we're seeing this in government after government, trying to do a couple of things simultaneously. And I think this is part of what got us to this juncture in this accelerated second wave, is that there has been a twin set of imperatives for governments to feel like they need to try to keep the spread of COVID to a minimum, but also do everything that they can to reignite or to sustain or to reinvigorate as much of the economy as possible. And so trying to do those two things at the same time, ultimately, it's not clear that you can, that we are in a situation where you pick one or the other. And if you pick and focus on keeping the economy going or reinvigorating the economy, that is just going to inflame COVID to the point that you're going to have to shut down the economy anyways. And so the short-term concerns about the economic activity inevitably lead to longer-term, larger-scale economic damage when you have to shut down everything or threaten the overload of your entire health system, which is where these waves potentially turn to real catastrophe.
And I understand there's some economic research that's come out in the past couple of weeks that show that when caseloads spike but new measures aren't put in place, you do see a significant drop-off in a lot of economic activity, which would very much suggest that it really is a false trade-off between doing an economic-focused response or a public health-focused response.
Yeah. And if you ask most economists about this. There aren't a huge number of economists around the country worrying about the economy. They are, by and large, saying you need to listen to the expertise of health officials, because in order to open the economy, you actually have to vanquish this larger threat. And so that's what we were doing in the spring. And to some extent, I think part of the tension here is that the provincial governments feel like they just have fewer resources to play with than fully federally response would imply, as we saw more in the spring and early summer during the first wave. And so provinces feel like they need to try to keep the lights on, economically speaking, that they can't afford to go with a full shutdown where people are effectively being paid to stay home without the backing of the federal government. So we have this nested series of collective action problems in Canada where people don't want to stay home because they feel like they can't afford to. They're worried about losing jobs or losing income. And then governments are afraid of shutting down the economy because they don't feel like they can afford to pay for that action. So they are trying to keep the economy going. And it all ultimately leads back to the need for coordinating effort and funding efforts from the federal government to make it okay for everyone to go back to that position we were in March and April and May, when as many people as possible were staying home and we were effectively paying people to stay home and making it as easy as possible to make that choice for employers and employees alike. And we've really moved away from that to some extent. And I think it's making this response more complex. And governments are inevitably trying to say we need to do everything to stamp out COVID, and also restaurants are still open. And that doesn't seem like a sustainable place to be. So I would not be surprised if we see additional orders coming through in the coming weeks to shut down more of those public spaces altogether.
Yeah, I think collective action problem hits the nail on the head. I don't have any particular insight into how the governments are discussing this internally, but it really feels like all the decision makers are very wary of actually making major decisions on this and are doing everything they can to put it off as long as possible or have someone else be the ones to make the call. And a lot of recommendations coming out, but very little in the way of actual quick and decisive decisions coming down from premiers, prime ministers, and in a lot of cases, even the public health officers.
Yeah, and it is interesting to see that the jurisdictions in Canada that seem like they've done the best are those that were the firmest up front, where some of the Atlantic provinces were willing to try to all but halt interprovincial travel and so on, and really trying to make it difficult for people to move around and come into the province for a period of time. And they're willing to return to that position as necessary in particular regions. And so the areas that have been on top of the virus have been the ones that ended up on top of the virus and able to reopen things as a result. And so it's more difficult and larger, more complex economies, more dense populations, that it is more difficult to try to put in place that level of control. But we do know that it is possible because we have done it in the spring and summer. And yeah, seems like we're just waiting to have additional leadership. And today was a big step forward, I think, for the provincial government in terms of the health controls. But that other piece of that economic piece is still missing, where it's not clear either that the more robust, muscled-up EI is not equal to the task, or if it is, to provide the funding that people need to make the choice to stay home when it is a safer choice that is not being communicated. So somewhere that gap needs to be filled, and it seems like the federal government needs to take more aggressive action here to enable provinces to do the same. It seems like there is a bit of a knock-on effect there, and until we see that, provinces are, I expect, going to stumble along a little bit trying to do this walk and chew gum thing where we are cracking down in terms of health measures, but we're also trying to keep as much of the economy open as possible.
Yeah, I should mention that Trudeau is scheduled for a press conference tomorrow in front of Rideau Cottage, which is very much reminiscent of the spring. So by the time this is out, there may be new announcements from the federal government on this, which would no doubt be welcome, because at some point, all the first ministers need to start making tough decisions because there's no one really else to do it.
Well, yeah, That is the structure of Canadian politics at the best of times. The decisions, the big decisions, all come to the premiers, the first ministers, and in a state of emergency, then that is all the more true. So we are looking for action, and I know it's not just BC, Ontario, Alberta, Manitoba, much Quebec. They're each province has a slightly different variation of the same intrinsic problem here. And so I wouldn't be surprised, you're right, if Trudeau takes some steps towards what we're talking about here tonight. And if so, you heard it here first, even if it's released after the announcement is made.
Moving on to quick takes. Speaking of decisiveness, Parliament has demanded the Liberals finally make a decision regarding Huawei and 5G. This is a opposition motion spearheaded by Conservative foreign policy critic Michael Chong that got support across the opposition benches to require the government to produce a decision on whether or not to permit Huawei products in Canada's 5G infrastructure within 30 days. This was passed 179 to 146. And that shows one of the how a minority parliament can really, I think, hold government's feet to the fire a lot more and stuff they're trying to delay and run out the clock on.
Yeah, it is a reminder that we are in a minority government situation, and with that comes more legislative adventures, and as you say, more demands for accountability. So we'll have to wait and see how the government responds here. And this is not binding in the sense that the government will fall if it doesn't meet the 30-day threshold, although then you might expect that it would lead to a motion to call out the government yet again and try to up the stakes a little bit. But we may yet see some maneuvering around this. And Canada has really played a long game with the decision on Huawei. It seems pretty clear that it is not eager to take that decision, that some of the other allies have already, particularly the other members of the Five Eyes intelligence alliance, that have started to plant their flags, either limiting the cooperation with Huawei, or in the American case being dead set against any cooperation. And so Canada is trying, they're caught in a hard place where we are in the American penumbra. We are part of the American sphere within the world, and yet we can't simply ignore China on the world stage. It commands such resources and such attention around the world that Canada can't simply ignore it. We're seeing that tension play out here, and the government is a little bit stuck in terms of making a decision on whether to incorporate Huawei into its 5G plans. And so I don't envy the government the decision, because there are real challenges in working with China, and there are real costs from turning our back on what is the most rapidly growing economy and political power in some ways in the world.
Yeah, we're, I think, the lone holdout on the Five Eyes that hasn't made a definitive no Huawei decision. Britain reversed course a couple months back on that. They were the other ones that taking a more conciliatory approach there. So yeah, it does put us really offside with our allies, and we're kind of getting a return to the old-timey great power geopolitics, and Canada's view of itself as a entirely neutral country isn't necessarily going to be able to hold up as that continues to develop. Although no doubt the government is trying to delay this until at least January 21st, if not a little longer. But the other interesting thing here is that we've seen this minority government, or the minority parliament, exercise its muscles a bit. But one of the areas that they've done the most is actually on foreign policy, with the special committee the Conservatives managed to get through on China, now this. And it's an interesting development in Canadian politics that usually tends to significantly downplay the importance of foreign policy, probably much more than it should.
Yeah, there does seem to be some symbolism here where The Conservative Party has hit on principled opposition to China as a good wedge issue for them, and they're abandoning it, language of really trying to engage China in more meaningful discourse. And it's understandable why. China is a big power, it's an important power, it's a big, important economy, and yet there are things that the Chinese regime itself is doing that are pretty odious with regard to Uyghur populations within China, with regard to pressure on the population in Hong Kong, and so on. And so this is an area where democracies around the world are having to grapple with. How do you deal with an increasingly assertive China that is not playing by the rules of that we have come to expect of liberal democracies, and obviously they fall short themselves as well. So there is that to consider. But China is a difficult issue to manage for any government, and the conservatives seem to have settled on this idea that they can make life uncomfortable with liberals who are trying to find some sort of middle ground on the issue by taking a more principled stance and opposing the excesses of the Chinese regime abroad and potentially influencing Canadians as well. This is another part of the motion that was just passed to ask for greater action in investigating the extent to which the Chinese government is influencing Chinese nationals in Canada. I'm always a little leery about these conversations because they can slip into xenophobia fairly quickly in the talk of what the Chinese regime itself is doing. For too many people can bleed into fairly knee-jerk forms of racism against Chinese people living in Canada and Chinese Canadians. And so there's a concern there that it becomes a stalking horse for racism. And yet it is important to be honest about what the Chinese regime is doing. And Canada does have to be honest about the stakes that are involved in cooperating with the Chinese regime and with not.
And finally, the Liberal government has unveiled a new climate policy bill today. So Bill C-12, the Canadian Net Zero Emissions Accountability Act, was introduced today. It sets targets for both 2030 as well as up through to 2050, where Canada is supposed to be net zero. Doesn't lay out a huge amount of detail in terms of how we're actually going to get there. And I think perhaps most notable, given its name, doesn't offer as much accountability as it says on the packaging. So while it does set targets, the first one is 10 years from now, and there's no real penalty or mechanism in the proposed law that would actually force the government to act if they're on track to miss the targets.
So I think the fact that it's being introduced into legislation itself, it matters. So a government that is not going to make the target would presumably simply pass a new legislation to amend the target. But even having to undergo that kind of act would be open the government up to criticism and suggestions that they are failing to meet their target. So they are essentially creating a reputational cost for not meeting these targets, and a stronger one than has existed previously. But you're right, there's still not enough teeth in terms of how to enforce these kinds of limits, and also how to manage the actual transition itself. So are we talking about wrapping up a carbon tax? Are we talking about subsidizing different kinds of industries? Are we talking about winding down subsidies to other kinds of industries that tend to be carbon intensive? So exactly what mixture of policies are going to get us there, we continue to wait that information.
Yeah, so it does set up a 15-member advisory board of outside experts to help advise the minister on this. But yeah, it's the first step in trying to hit the targets. It's not anywhere near the end of it. And I think we'll have to see what actually comes out of this, because there's still a long way to go from stuff the government announced during its last term and started to implement, and what actually needs to be done both in general and to actually hit net zero by 2050.
Yeah, very much in a stay tuned sort of situation. And part of this will depend, too, on, of course, what the next government does. So it's possible the Liberals will be still in power in 2030 and Justin Trudeau will still be prime minister. But I would tend to suspect that is not the case. Canadians get tired of governments after a period of time and look for change. And so a big part of the success or failure of this is going to depend on how widespread acceptance of the need for these measures becomes within Canadian society. And so ultimately, the force for change will come in part from political leadership, but it will also come from broader social pressure and the expectation that whoever is elected, they are going to take this challenge seriously, this important challenge that we've, to some extent, taken some focus off in the midst of the coronavirus epidemic, but is still there as the larger policy challenge of our lifetime.
I think I saw one headline that read, Trudeau commits successor to climate action.
Yeah, not a bad way to understand it. But of course, there are limits on how far any one parliament can bind the next. But by enshrining it in law and then requiring a future parliament to change the law if they are going to take a different direction, that at least forces a kind of action where it's not just a proposal of a more pie in the sky or a hot air target that there is no need to even to rewrite anything in order to miss. You just miss it and get on with your lives, which is the way in which previous targets have operated in Canada.
Oh, Stuart, thanks for joining me tonight and stepping in on a bit of short notice. Why don't you tell the listeners where they can find you?
They can't find me on the SFU campus because I never go there anymore, but I am still teaching at SFU and I teach a few courses at Douglas, and I am always to be found on Twitter at Stuart Prest. And feel free to come and say hi.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Politicoast is a production of Legend Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Wash your hands and stay home. Thanks for listening.